What's up, Rebels? Happy New Year. Welcome back to Rebel Radio. I hope that in 2015, we lived up to your very low expectations of us, and I hope to set them even lower for this year. That's my goal. What's your goal? You make New Year's resolutions? If you do, I really don't care, so don't post that on Twitter. Post something else on Twitter, at Rebel Radio Net, and wish us a Happy New Year or something else. Hey, my guest today is Peanut Butter Wolf. Man, this dude is a unique individual. He's the founder of Stone's Throw Records. They're going on their 20th anniversary now in 2016. And if you don't know Stone's Throw, they're an important label in underground hip-hop, but so much more than that as they explore different genres, and we're going to talk about that in the interview. He's known for giving us records from Madlib, Madvillain, J Dilla, some of Dilla's best work, Mayor Hawthorne, friend of Rebel Radio, Aloe Black with the hit I Need a Dollar. Those are just some of his releases, and on top of that, he's a DJ, and this dude is like, I would describe him as a pure creative. We're going to talk in the interview about how he's built this business over the years, and if you heard the Dave Weiner interview from last week, it's interesting to me because these are two guys that have both been very successful, complete opposite approaches. And, you know, where Dave, you know, we talked about his approach, which is very business-minded, very research-driven, all that stuff. And Peanut Butter Wolf is just, he makes records that he wants to listen to, and sometimes you want to listen to him too. Anyway, we'll get into that and a lot more. But first, let's hear the EDM.com track of the week.
Didn't do it, yes you did. Now she's leaving with the kids, never gonna forgive ya. It is what it is, moved out and she was gone.
The dear John letter.
Red Aaron, you was wrong, now you can be alone.
I can find better.
But without you, our house is not a home. How did I sing that song?
She said middle finger.
Staring at the goggles in my dome, fearing that I don't got no self-control. And I'm airing out
the. Maybe you guys hear our background noise. We're live in the streets. Actually, we're indoors, but we've added these ambient noises in for your listening pleasure. That was Abstract Rude with a track called Still Was Mine as the EDM.com track of the week. And now your interview with Peanut Butter Wolf. Peanut Butter Wolf.
What's up, man?
Thanks for being here.
No headphones. I like that. It's different.
Oh, yeah. Keep it easy, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate you coming. You know, I said in my email to you that, you know, you're sort of the perfect guy in a lot of ways for this show, because, you know, as much as it's about culture and hip-hop and the love of music, it's also about entrepreneurship,
right?
And you kind of blend those things together in yeah. really a unique way. And I think, you know, as I was doing some research, I learned kind of more about just how uniquely you've managed to do that. And you know, we've known each other over the years, but it's always yeah. like, you know, a handshake usually behind the tables,
right?
You know, at a party.
Exactly.
And so, you know, I'm excited to have you here and to dig in a little bit to how you're doing it.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Thank you.
What, so many things I want to get into, but I like to start maybe at the beginning.
Right.
And when did you know you were going to make music for a living?
Well, I would say, like, I mean, I started, really, I guess I started DJing and making beats at the same time. And at this point, hip hop was, it was kind of the Run DMC era where it was really stripped down, just drum machine and then scratching a stab from a record, from a disco record, like, wham, and, or like a rock record. And, yeah, so that was like early. Well, no, not early, like mid-80s, and I would record stuff, you know, what I was doing. So I think at that point, I mean, it was really, it was a dream, but I wasn't sure, like, how far I would be able to take it or anything. Because I did, there were always people telling me that I wouldn't make it doing that, basically. I mean, especially being in San Jose, because
yeah.
San Jose is not necessarily the epicenter of hip hop music or music in general. I mean,
sure. Especially at the time, it was pretty suburban.
Yeah.
But like, yeah. Now it's a big city.
Yeah. I mean, I really like growing up in high school. I guess my friends were from all different races and stuff, and that was like, you know, that was just like always what I knew. All my best friends were Black, Mexican, Filipino, you know, everything, mm-hmm. Indian. So from that standpoint, you know, San Jose was progressive. And as I got older, like when I started releasing records, people would say, oh, that's that West Coast sound. And I didn't even know there really was a West Coast sound.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
Other than like Summer of Love type, like 60s. And, but I'm kind of jumping all over the place. So, but the mid 80s, I think, you know, and I actually have a high school term paper that I wrote where it said, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I wanted to start a record label.
Nice.
And at that point, the labels, all my favorite hip hop was coming out on independent labels.
Yeah.
The Cold Chillins of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot. Profiled, Def Jam, of course. And
so do you remember the first party you played?
First, well, yeah, I mean, I did like house parties and stuff. The first time I was really on a stage, I think, performing for people was 1987, and that was, I was opening for Trinier, who was mm-hmm. like a freestyle artist.
Yeah.
Yeah, so she was big in the freestyle world and like unknown outside of it, and it's still that way for her. She still does shows and stuff, but yeah, I remember she came in a pink Rolls Royce limousine, and she like kicked me out of the backstage, and she really had a lot of attitude and stuff, and I was like this nervous little kid, like, oh, sorry.
Yeah.
But
what'd you play?
Well, I was in a group with a rapper named Cool Breeze, actually, at the time, so I was DJing for him. He was rapping, and I was just scratching, and it was my beats and stuff. So,
mm-hmm.
And we recorded that at this guy Alexander Mejia's place, who's still kind of in the music industry.
Sure. Alex was like he's a legend in the Bay Area.
Yeah, exactly.
Put a lot of people on the map.
Absolutely. So, but I mean, yeah, those early days, I think what really got me kind of believing that it could happen was seeing King Shameek, who was also from San Jose,
mm-hmm.
and he moved to New York, and then he started working with Twin Hype and King Sun and a lot of people. And I remember I would see him on TV on BET, like he had a 900 number with Twin Hype, and I was like, dang, this dude made it. Like, he's from San Jose and he's like on TV. And so that really, after that, I was like, I'm gonna really pursue this more, you know?
Yeah. And so
that was around 1990, I guess.
Okay.
And that's when I put out my first record. I put out a record, a group called Lyrical Prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm about to flow. In case you don't know, this is my intro. Soaring like I'm Jordan, rhythm soul. Focus is retreated with style. More like a rhyme from a genius living god. I'm ready to swarm. Quizzes, pillars, never fresh or cock back. I never turn back. No, I cleanse my verbs and listen to Cisco's find an ad-lap. Diversity of lyrics, I'm here like this. Sitting in your hair, I zone and start to flare.
Step in the darkness, a path is next in. The journey to void yet, the marks are flexed in. The swing is magic, a metaphor is chosen. The brain is active. That you left it be frozen. Prodigals left on the scene where I'm warring. Flaming the dome, another fist is swarming. Hands down in the chamber of horrors. It's our third eye, the land of darkness. Sending a message to the soul when I dispatch. Note for note, every message you add that. Lyrical madness, phasing, engaging. Attack the.
Three, me and two other people put the money in and were trying to do all the promotion because I was DJing on college radio at the time. So.
Okay. Was there like a vision at the time for what you were trying to create, or were you just kind of in the flow and you just sort of did it?
I did, and I do. I have all that stuff still, too. I keep everything, like, I write. Like, I have, like, notes, like, you know, all the goals, like, being in The Source. You're saying that you wrote for The Source and, like, being on In Living Color and all this stuff. But, I mean, it was a lot more intricate than that. That's just kind of what I remember right now.
Yeah.
But with that record, it was like... Because Hammer was out and
mm-hmm.
Too Short and E-40, and that was about it from the Bay Area. And what we were doing was a lot more conscious, like East Coast, Rakim influence, Nation of 5%, kind of, you know, Brand Nubian and all that. So,
yeah.
We had like a real strong vision of what we wanted to do. And then the other guy that made the beats with me, he... later changed his name. His name was DJ Raleem, and then he changed his name to Assassin, and he was like doing all the Bay Area gangsta stuff.
Okay.
He did stuff with Tupac and like,
yeah.
You But yeah, that I mean, by 1990, I definitely knew that this is, at that point, I was real passionate about it, and I was like, "This is, I'm going to do this."
Yeah. And was there, you know, you mentioned labels, you know, Coachella and Def Jam and stuff like that, mostly on the East Coast, mm-hmm. right, that you kind of looked up to.
They were, yeah.
Was there a mentor or at that time, or somebody kind of helping you shape, figure out what to do, or were you just like, was it trial and error, or how does that come together?
On the label side, yeah, I mean, I think like Def Jam, because there was always, even back then, we knew that it was started, I think probably from the Crush Groove movie or something, but it was kind of started in their basement and,
yeah.
you know, college students and stuff. So when you hear about that, then that definitely encourages you to push forward with it. But, mm-hmm. You know, there was it was also kind of an uphill battle doing quote unquote East Coast hip hop in the Bay Area, because
sure.
nobody wanted to hear that really. They were like, you're from the West and you sounding like the East. And then when Cypress Hill came out and Far Side, then it was a little more accepted, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, now, you know, in retrospect, you know, we have the Far Side, we have Freestyle Fellowship, we have,
yeah,
you know, the Hyrule exactly. thing. Yep. And, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, those lines are very much more blurred.
And those were the early ones. I mean, yeah. now it's, yeah, it's just all like, you know, you got ASAP Rocky sounding like he's from the South and he's from New
sure.
York, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't really sound like he's from anywhere anymore, but.
Yeah, but that's because it's
the influences
sort of
are everywhere.
Happening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Absolutely. But no, I remember those times when it was, you were either sort of East Coast or West Coast,
right.
or, you know, you're expected to sort of fall into these pockets.
There was a super division.
Yeah.
And watching the NWA movie, it kind of brought me back to that.
For sure.
Yeah. But I mean, they had an appreciation for the East Coast as well. And I think, you know, like the Ultimate Breaks and Beats is basically in the mid to late 80s mm-hmm. to the 90s. Like that's where everybody was getting their samples from. And that's why you could make hip hop anywhere around the world and it would still sound like quote unquote hip hop, you know,
mm-hmm.
as long as you use that SB 1200 and the Ultimate Breaks and Beats, then you're good.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. You mentioned that. Cause you know, you're kind of known as a collector, a digger.
Right.
For sure. And, you know, watching the Stone's Throw documentary, we see you, buried under a lot of records. I know that's important to you.
Yeah.
How did that happen, and how do you, how does that play a role in what you do? Because you sort of took, like,
yeah.
everyone was using Ultimate Beats and Breaks, right?
They were, so yeah.
You sort of took that.
And that was, like, for me, because that was another thing about living in San Jose. There really weren't record stores where you could buy used records. There's a store called Streetlight where I would find, yeah. you know, you could find, well, I was going to say James Brown, but you couldn't even find that. That was too rare, you know?
Really?
Until the reissues came out in like 86, but I mean, you do the thrift store thing and you get lucky like one out of every 20 times you go there, and you know, other than that, it's like really just meeting people who have parents who had the records, and
mm-hmm.
you know, you bought quote unquote borrow their records, and but yeah, I mean, listening to my early productions, it was a lot of the Ultimate Breaks, and that was available, you could get those, I guess, like at Tower Records, but even then, you would go, and out of like 25 volumes, there would always only be like one or two that was in stock. Everything would be sold out. Those records were just super rare.
Mm-hmm. So do you think, you know, one thing that stands out to me about your career, and, you know, we'll talk a lot about Stone's Throw, and as a label, I think you guys you've accomplished a tremendous amount and made big contributions to the culture, right? From bringing the world Madlib, to the work you did with JD, to Mayor Hawthorne, to Aloe Black,
yeah.
and a much longer list that we can go into.
Yeah.
But just right there.
And Dame Funk and Doom, those are the ones really. Like,
absolutely.
Yeah, those are probably like the five or six, you know, that,
sure.
that people know. But,
but beyond that, like there's been, you know, you've had a lot of room for experimentation.
That's what I enjoy more. And in a way, it's like it almost makes it less of a cohesive label, but I don't really, I just don't care about that. I just want to put out what I want. I'm really, I don't know, headstrong or stubborn or whatever with that.
Yeah.
They say Libras are stubborn, so maybe that's what it is. But.
So how does that work from a business perspective?
Well, it's tricky for sure. I remember when I started experimenting more, and, you know, really Stone's Throw in my mind was always experimental. When I put out Quasimodo, that was very experimental. Nobody was making hip hop like that. And, mm-hmm. you know, when I approached Madlib about releasing it, because that was something he just did on the side for fun, and he's like, really, you really want to put that out? Like, he was surprised, but he was happy. He was like, I'm down. Like, if you're down, I'm down. I just didn't think you'd like this.
Hey yo, we head to a party, then go see what's happening. Smoking the law in the car, turn on some rapping, start the freestyle, we be up on our way, finish up the blunt,
somebody passes that spray,
get on the freeway, yo, it's after dark. Guess it always pulls up right behind the can, some narcs, letting all kinds of speed cars pass, just so he can harass our black ass. Police pulling us over for no reason, searching the car like it's nigga hunting season, year round, asking about where's the pound, where's the guns, are y'all niggas on the run, you got warrants, y'all niggas ready for some torment, that's how they be cracking, it seems like they be acting, except it's real life, like they rushing up your residence, searching your crib.
I mean, even though that was something that it took a minute for people to catch on to. Like, I remember Bobito, like, when I gave it to him, he wasn't really feeling it at first. And, you know, that was and still is somebody that I always really look up to, mm-hmm. for his opinions and stuff and hip hop. And that was frustrating to me more, like, running into those hurdles with it. But now, like, looking back, like, that's Quasimodo's, like, something that a lot of people relate to and get a tattoo of, and, you know, they're real passionate about it. Yeah. But it seems like, yeah, with the more chances that I take, I remember there, like, because hip hop, there is like that kind of keep it real attitude that it's not, I mean, most people aren't really that way anymore, but there are some where, mm-hmm. this guy made like a Stone's Throw Fell Off t-shirt and was selling it all the hip hop shows, you know,
because
I started releasing like stuff that wasn't really hip hop or, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah. So I guess I'm wondering, how much is that a plan versus just not giving a shit?
It was really not giving a shit for me, but I think in a way that kind of kept me afloat almost. Like, it was like a happy accident, because at the time hip hop, the Keep It Real hip hop had gotten kind of stale to the point where people were either trying to do different things with rap music, or they were just going into different musics altogether. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like Odd Future is a good example for me. Like, they came, their interest in Stone's Throw wasn't even necessarily the hip hop acts. It was, they were into John T and they were into James Pants, and mm-hmm. they found out about Stone's Throw through that stuff. And they're supposed to be, like, you know, the kings of hip-hop for the youth. And
right.
And the fact that they are gravitating towards that more, that made me feel proud. Like, okay, I'm, like, kind of on the right track with the kids, too, possibly. Like, you know, I mean, that's not what I do it for, I guess. But
But how much do you pay attention to that? Like, you know, a traditional label... Mm-hmm. You know, they have a research department, you know, they're right. And, you know, they're following the trends on YouTube and, you know, yeah. and all that stuff. And I know you're, in addition to running the label, you know, you're a DJ, you're out a lot.
Yeah.
You're really connected to the party.
That's
kind
of how I do it more. It's more intuitive and
yeah.
It's just an extension of who I am. It's not, yeah, I don't know. I mean, first of all, I can't really afford to go after the people with the big buzz.
Sure.
That's just never really, it hasn't been our business model, but it also, I guess I take pride in discovering things before anybody else knows about it anyways. I mean, there's like an example, like Snoop Dogg working with Dame, that's like an example of the exception rather than the rule. Like, mm-hmm. normally I wouldn't work with somebody who has already that established, but that made sense because it was something different, and Snoop was just really open, you know, to Dame's ideas. Like, Dame had full creative control of the music and stuff, and
yeah,
so that worked out really well for us creatively.
Niggas hit the pavement when I come through slow in a 6-4 hanging out the window. Niggas hit the pavement when I fall through the club, chucking up the dub on you scrubs. Niggas hit the pavement, DF on the beat. If you don't work, you don't eat. Niggas hit the pavement. Real true state, grind till they pay me. Real niggas hit the pavement. I'm in a coat, white DM, just clocked in at 11 p.m.
Generally, I usually sign artists who have zero SoundCloud, zero YouTubes, you know, all that, like,
yeah,
no nothing out really.
Yeah, well, it makes me wonder. I mean, I kind of think of Stone's Throw less as a label and more as a cult, like,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think you just have fans that are devoted and have kind of bought into what you're doing. And I almost wonder if that would happen as much if you were making safer bets or bets that, from a business perspective, kind of make more sense.
Yeah, I mean, I never thought of that until you said it right now. That's true.
And then I'm sure that, you know, you have, you know, as you said, there's probably some people that don't get it and that are, they may get into one record, but then, you know, mm-hmm. nothing sounds the same. So
yeah.
You know, you sort of lose people along the way.
Right. And it's almost like a snake shedding skin or something. Like, I think that's like a necessary thing sometimes. I mean, as long, I don't expect everybody to be along for the ride. Like, you know, it's been, well, it'll be 20 years in a, like, very soon. But, I mean, basically, as long as I'm paying the bills and still putting out stuff that I feel happy about, then that's pretty much what I do it for.
Yeah, that's awesome. So talk about, I know the 20-year anniversary is coming up.
Yeah.
Anything you can, any plans you can share with us?
I mean, we're just going to tour a lot. We didn't do like a 20-year album or any of that kind of stuff, but I mean, there's like, we're co-branding with some companies and stuff on different things, but the main thing is we're gonna just do shows like all over the world, try to get some of the old artists and some of the new artists together on a tour. So
nice. Yeah, so I know that, you know, parties have been a big part of what you've done. You had all the I don't know what you called those, but all the kind of numbered dates.
Oh, uh-huh, yeah.
July 7th, 2007, and August 8th, 2008, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That
was fun for a while.
Yeah, I bet.
For that. I mean.
So are the parties important to you personally? Are they important to the business? Is it some of each?
I think that series you're talking about, and specifically, that was just to keep having fun with it, because I've been DJing for so long. I mean, like I said, my first time on stage was 1987, so mm-hmm. it's, you know, most people at the clubs were born after 1987, so it's just, yeah, it's like the, like, for 12 12 12, I DJed 12 hours straight for Boiler Room, and my idea for that was just to play all different types of music and not even mix, not like a nightclub set. And
yeah,
people would get online and they didn't understand that, and they're like, why am I watching this? He's just standing there like playing records. And it wasn't even meant to be watched, it was more meant to be listened to. And and all these people are defending it and like explaining it to them, and like, it's, you know,
yeah,
it's performance art. I don't know.
Well, that's what's interesting, right, is when the crowd gets involved,
yeah,
and, you know, and defends you or you know, puts their own take on it, right? And
I love that.
Yeah,
this girl made fun of my name. She was like a comedian. She made fun of my name on Twitter or something, and then I just wrote #white girl problems, and then like all the people at follow my stuff, they were all defending me, like, just like, I mean, I never even like get into that stuff usually, but
yeah,
it was just funny to see.
That's funny. So you know, with that in mind, how do you judge the success of a project? It's obviously, you know,
yeah,
I would imagine it's not just about how many copies you sold.
Right. Yeah. It just really depends what your definition of success is, because some of my most successful records in my head were the ones that I just really like how it turned out. And, you know, I got like some opinions from people who I really respect, like just inspired by it, or yeah, I mean,
what's one of those?
I mean, Gary Wilson, a lot of people, Gary Wilson, he was kind of known in the outsider world, but he wasn't known in the hip hop world. And then a lot of people in hip hop, that was just another example, like the Odd Future, just off the top of my head. But
yeah,
I mean, there's like an artist, Koshik, that I really like, that I put his stuff out and it didn't really sell very well. And he never did a single show in his life. He just, I mean, he did some DJ gigs, but he's never sang in front of an audience. And as long as the artist doesn't have expectations that aren't met and the record sounds good, then that's a success to me still. You know, I mean, I, of course, I always want, my goal is for like all the people that I work with to be able to make a career out of it where they don't have to have like a side job or anything like that. So
sure.
That's something that I kind of have in the back of my mind with artists. But like Vex Ruffin is an artist. I'm working on his second album with him right now. And I had an idea to have Fab Five Freddy on a track. And, you know, I sent it to him. And he was like, oh, this totally reminds me of like what it was like in Lower East Side in 1983 and blah, blah, blah. You know, and he was like, I'm in. Like, you know, I'm going to, I'll be on the track. And so I guess that's a success to me, that when that kind of stuff happens as well.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine that happens a lot, or that you know, you're bringing people the opportunity to have a more sort of culture experience.
Right.
As opposed to just strictly the business. You know, we often talk about on this show how the business has kind of eaten up the culture in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. Or it's sort of dictated the direction that the culture's gone.
Yeah.
You know, I think certainly the major labels and even a lot of the indies, like, you know, they're following the trends rather than dictating them.
Yeah.
Which just means that, you know, people go after what sells, right? So I think when you're able to offer people an alternative to that, that's probably pretty attractive.
Yeah.
Are there folks like that that you, you know, you mentioned Snoop. Are there other folks that, you know, you decide you want to work with, not so much for commercial reasons, but to sort of bring them into that experience?
Well, Steve Arrington was one. Also, he was someone that I really was into as a kid. I would ride my bike and play his music on a boombox. You know, to work with him was a dream come true. So, and that record didn't do very well either. That was him and Dame doing something together.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, you know, he's an artist that, I mean, he was making records in the 70s and 80s, and then he basically just completely stopped doing it for spiritual reasons and stuff, and just got really deep in the church. And then Dame Funk pretty much, I wouldn't say brought him out of retirement, but, you know, was, I guess, at the right place at the right time and convinced him to work with us. And he's just went to Tokyo for the first time in his career. And it's, you know, his career is like 40 years or longer. So
yeah,
when you hear stuff like that, it makes me happy, you know, that I was even a part of it in a small way.
Absolutely. Yeah. What about that? What do you, I mean, I would imagine that the artists you work with learn a lot from you, because you have a very, you know, seemed like a very specific point of view on music. And what do you learn from them?
I mean, I'm always learning stuff from everybody, like, and sometimes it's just kind of observing and just, yeah, that's a tough one. Like, I mean, like, we got the No Worries Project with Knowledge and Anderson .Paak.
Smooth in the motherfucker. Suede on the inside. Candy paint. I ain't gotta tell you what the rims look like. Look, I'm gripping wood like a motherfucker. She asked me, can a friend ride? Kelly wanna have a drink. And Shawnee wanna pop pills all night. Look, don't be fucking with my tape, dad. You gon' listen to this Marvin. You gon' listen to this Bloodstone. Oh, y'all niggas want that Barry White. Well, I don't really fuck with that right there.
He just kind of gave me like a booster shot almost, just seeing Anderson like just do so much in such a small amount of time. And I think he's really going to go far, like a lot further than I could be responsible for. And, you know, he's just worked stuff out with Dre. I mean, he was on Dre's album, of course, but I think he's going to be doing stuff with him, you know, in the future. And yeah, I'm very happy to be doing what we're doing with him, and him and Knowledge's project together is, you know, it's like exactly what I like personally for Stone's Throw. But he also has sounds that are going to go, you know, other places as well. So, but I mean, it's not like he taught me anything, but he just reminded me like how far a smile will go, and like believing in yourself, but being positive and, you know, being courteous and kind to everybody else. And
yeah,
it makes everybody like want to work for him like harder, you know?
Mm-hmm. What about Madlib? It seems like Madlib had a pretty big impact on the label early on.
Yeah. I mean, still, but like, yeah, probably out of any artist that I've worked with, he's probably the, if I had to pick one, he's probably the biggest part of Stone's Throw, you know, from an artist's standpoint.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a good run of like maybe 5 or 6 years where that's really was the focus of Stone's Throw, was to just try to keep up with everything he was doing. Cause he was working with so many artists, and he was doing jazz, and he was doing hip hop, and
yeah,
doing broken beat, electronic music. And I don't know, but Madlib.
So does that take the label in a different direction, or is it like, you know, you have your thing? Like, is it? Let me get the question together.
Yeah, I mean,
like, is it kind of what you're doing? Is it just all encompassing to include these things, or do you kind of get shifted, you know, a little bit with each experience?
With Madlib, I was definitely, yeah, getting shifted, because, like, I remember when he first told me he wanted to do a jazz album, and I had never thought Stone's Throw would release a jazz record, but, and I didn't know that he knew how to play instruments at all. He just, he was like a master at sampling, and which is a total art form in itself, but I didn't think he could just jump on every instrument. And like, you know, he was just like, he didn't, I think he never really cared about criticism, and that's like his beauty, is that like when he said he was going to do this, and I said, well, you know, it was almost like a challenge. Like, let's see if you can, if we go and buy all these instruments. And we bought like bunch of different electric pianos and synthesizers and drums and upright bass, and you know, and he learned how to play all of it, like not like a pro, but good enough to put his ideas down and and get them out of his system. And I remember when we met Weldon Irvin, Weldon was just like, there's no way this brother just learned how to play instruments, like last year. I'm going to look him in the face, and I could tell when someone's lying. And, you know, he was saying, like, some of his other hip-hop. Because he started teaching hip-hop artists how to play keys and stuff, mm-hmm. like kind of as a side thing. And he was like, you know, so-and-so, like, can't even, like, do, like, 1/50th of what Madlib's already doing. And I've been working with this guy for, like, you know, 2 or 3 years, so.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we rented a vibraphone, and, like, we rented it for a month, and the first 3 weeks he learned how to play it, and then the last week he played it, like, you know, recorded it for the album.
Crazy.
And, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I imagine working with people with that level of talent is just really inspiring.
It was, yeah, I mean, it was a fun ride, like, working, you know, I mean, we all lived together at that time, and that was good times.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's another thing that stands out is I mean, you guys still work out of a house, right?
Mm-hmm.
And people live there from time to time? Is that?
Everybody's kind of moved to their own places. Madlib has his own place, and
but for a while.
Yeah, we all did. Yeah. I mean, like, the early years, for sure. Like, Stone's Throw was run out of a house that I had. And at one point, it was me, Jeff, Ethan, Madlib. Doom was there for a few months. And then everybody's girlfriends. And it was just, you know. And then there were all these, like, TV shows wanting to do one of those real world type things. And we were like, no.
I bet. So is that a good idea? If you were advising a startup, would you tell them, you know, you guys should all live together?
Oh, I mean, I kind of, like, when I went to Sawra's house, I remember one time I noticed they were all living together, and they had, like, their setup was, like, in the kitchen, and, you know, and that's kind of how it was with Madlib, too. Like, he just had everything everywhere. Like, it was pretty chaotic at one point.
Yeah.
But then we got the bomb shelter. When we moved to another house, there was a literal bomb shelter, because it was like Cold War. It was, you know, made in the Cold War era. And yeah, I remember there would be coffee cups, and I would like be cleaning up, and he's like, no, that's percussion. Don't throw that out. Like, it would have, like, you know, something in it.
No way.
Yeah, he just, like, really just made do with whatever was laying around.
Sure. So what's been the most commercially successful record on Stone's Throw?
Well, I would say I'm not really even, I can tell you the three, but I don't know what's 1, 2, and 3 in that order, but it's definitely the Mad Villain, the Aloe Black, and Donuts.
So nasty that it's probably somewhat of a travesty having me. Then he told the people, you can call me your majesty. Keep your battery charged. He know it won't stick, yo. And it's not his fault you kick slow. Should've let your trick hold, chick hold your sick glow. Plus nobody couldn't do nothing once he let the brick go. And you know I know, that's a bunch of snow. The beat is so butter. Peep the slow cutter as he utter the calm flow. Don't talk about my mom, yo. Sometimes he rhyme quick, sometimes he rhyme slow, or vice versa. Whip up a slice of nice verse.
I don't know which order.
Yeah,
they kind of fluctuate, but.
And do those, so Mad Villain would have been the first one.
In terms of when we
just
released
in order,
it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Uh huh.
So does that change the game for you? Like, how is it different before that record versus after?
I mean, I could answer that either way. I could say that it did, and I could say that it didn't, and have like a good argument for it.
All right, let's hear it. Let's hear both sides.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it made things. It made things the same, because I had a success under my belt, so I could experiment and do whatever the fuck I want now. Am I supposed
to? Yeah.
Am I allowed to cuss? I don't know.
Please.
I've tried not to this whole time.
Oh, no. We encourage it.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, it's just made it able for me to do whatever I want. But then I guess on the other way to look at it is when you have a success, then people are waiting for another success, and you kind of have to. But I try not to let that influence my creative process of, you know, who I'm going to work with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, you mentioned, you know, people are expecting that. You don't have investors or
right.
No one really to answer to, right?
Mm-mm. Almost got bought up by Ruckus, like,
15
years or like 12 years ago, but I didn't, you know, go through with it. And I've had major labels like step in, but not,
I'm sure.
I mean, really, like, a lot of the successes that I've had were highly sample music, you know, so that's a nightmare for major labels.
Right.
I mean, even, I don't know if it's still the case, but I noticed maybe a year ago that The Chronic wasn't on iTunes. I was really surprised about that.
Mm-hmm.
And De La Soul, like, none of their albums are really on iTunes. Like,
is that just samples?
Well, with De La Soul, I know it is. With The Chronic, I don't know. I was surprised.
Interesting. I think it is now. Cause
The Chronic's on it now?
I think so.
Yeah.
I thought I saw it after the deal. Be sort of embarrassing not to have it on there if he's a...
Oh, after the movie?
Well, no, just after Dre's, you know, a big part of Apple Music now.
Oh, right, right, right.
So I think when that happened, I think it's on.
We're going to check.
That's right.
After this. Investors.
Yeah, so you don't have those sort of outside pressures.
I do in that I have a staff, and I don't want to ever have to lay off staff. And, you know, I have, like, I think 12 or 15 people, like, in the U.S. and Europe mostly.
Yeah.
And one in Japan. But, I mean, there's more responsibilities now than there was when I was renting a house for $700 a month and, you know, had a staff of one myself and was mixing down the records in my house and whatever. So
how does that weigh on your decisions, your creative decisions?
I mean, it really hasn't had to, though, because I have a big enough catalog where I can sell ones and twos of a lot of different things and, you know, still make ends meet. Like, I don't have to have, like, a hit record to, like, keep the lights on necessarily. But, and, you know, just, I mean, it's really, the hits do come and go, like, a lot of times, even without me, like, being able to know what's going to be a hit. Aloe Black's second album, I was, like, very, very close to not releasing it at all because I didn't.
That was Good Things?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I couldn't even think of the name of it. I think that's it. Yeah, because it was, like, a close thing where I wasn't really 100% behind how that album turned out. And he was a frustrated artist where he, you know, he had been showing me music for maybe a year or two in between albums, and we weren't really seeing eye to eye creatively.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was tough for me because usually when I don't want to be that label that is making people go back to the drawing board. But at the same time, when the Stone Star logo's on the back, I want to be proud of it too. So
sure.
It's kind of.
So how do you balance that? How do you balance your own vision with an artist's creative freedom?
I mean, I really like just sign artists. I try to sign artists where it's already like a full package without my involvement. Like I'm not trying to like mastermind it and be the puppet master where I'm changing everything around. And I think that was because when I was in a group with Charisma, we were on a major label. And once they signed us, they tried to change everything. And I was like, what are you guys signing then? Why did you sign us? I don't get it. But with that situation, the guy who signed us was the A&R, but then he had the powers that be that he had to, like, you know, answer to, I guess. But, but yeah, for the most part, I mean, a great example would have been Jonty, where he had recorded, mixed, and mastered everything and gave it to me before I even knew anything, like before I knew him. And I heard it and I listened to it and I liked it start to finish and didn't have to do anything with it, you know. like the White Boys record is similar to that. I didn't have any creative input other than I listened to it and I said, let's do this. You know, it's good. It's good as is. I don't need to change anything.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes artists, they encourage my involvement more that way. And I, you know, I get excited about doing that as well. I mean, I was like with Mad Villain, I was involved like with sequencing it and mixing and, you know, that the more technical stuff, I guess. But yeah, I mean, usually with an artist, I feel like they're so great that it's not going to be a big problem.
So back to the Aloe Black record, that was a, you know,
oh, that was, yeah, that was a almost didn't put out, but you know, in hindsight, I'm glad that we did. And, I mean, his, he reaches a totally different audience than Stones Throw. And you know, like the people, the diehard Stones Throw fans that get the Quasimodo and Mad Villain tattoos, they're not into Aloe Black's music at all. But
right.
At the same time, he was able to go a lot further than, you know, our traditional fan base. So
yeah. So when something like that happens, like, how does that impact the decisions you make after that?
What happens?
When so you have I Need a Dollar, which becomes a
right.
pretty big hit.
Yeah.
Right. And like you said, exposes a new audience that maybe you're not reaching with the
but
rest of your
new
releases.
Audience didn't care about Stones Throw. Like, they didn't go back and buy anything else on Stones Throw either. They were just really, I Need a Dollar, and that was it.
I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Well, I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. Hey, hey. Said I need a dollar, 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 that's what I need. And if I share with you my story, would you share your dollar with me? Bad times are coming and I reap what I done sowed. Hey, hey. Well, let me tell you something.
So some people would probably be tempted to then, like, that becomes the direction
to look
of the label.
For stuff like that. And right. I, honestly, like, I got a lot of submissions from people that had that sound, and that was frustrating because I wasn't looking for that sound. I just know what I like when I hear it.
Sure.
I mean, Myron and E was like the closest thing maybe to that sound that, and I really love how that album turned out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine you got a bunch of White Soul demos after Mayor Hawthorne came out.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Yep. But really, like, after Mayor Hawthorne came out, then Aloe said, well, I can do this, like, you know, I can do this better than Mayor, probably. I'm gonna go that direction. I'm not gonna, because his first album was like Future Soul, kind of like Giles Peterson, you know.
Right. Yeah. And so are you like, how tempted are you then to sort of follow that? Because I think it's normal. Maybe normal is not the right word, but, you know, it, traditional business.
Yeah.
You sort of follow your success, right? And
right.
You know, there's this whole idea of the pivot, like you see what's working and then you just do more of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kind of describing the opposite.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, like...
And that was kind of illustrated in the movie, too, I think. Like,
they
said that after Dilla passed away, then they kind of made it look like I lost my mind and just went for only, like, weirdo music or something.
A little bit.
Yeah, and that...
How true is that?
It was a little true, but it wasn't, like, so much like, okay, we lost Dilla, now I'm doing this. Like, I was putting out Gary Wilson while Dilla was alive, and Dilla would be like, oh, I love Gary Wilson. What's up with Gary Wilson? And, you know, he was living with Common, and Common would always ask about him. And I don't know if they were, like, messing with me or, like... But, I mean, I know... Knowing Dilla, I know he would have really liked it. Like, Dilla turned me on to Bruce Hack, who's another kind of outsider artist. More electronic, though. But, but yeah, I mean, it was kind of counterintuitive, I guess, like... To not want to, like, because after Dilla passed away, also, then every beat maker on the planet wanted to be on Stone's Throw because of Donuts, you know.
Of course.
So.
Yeah. So, I want to talk about that for a minute. You know, one of the things that I'm fascinated by is how you bounce back from adversity. And, you know, you've had two people really close to you who died kind of at the, maybe the peak or at, you know, mm-hmm. when they were on top of the game, right? First yeah. Charisma and then Dilla. So how do you handle that? How do you get back in the game or stay focused on what you came to do when stuff like that happens?
I never really thought about it. I just did it. I mean, when I lost Charisma, I stopped doing music for a long time.
Yeah.
Not a long time, like 6 months, but that was a long time to me when I was mm-hmm. doing it every day. But, I don't know. Yeah. That was the one thing that Snoop's like, Snoop called me the day after, like he saw the movie and he was like, he said that it really reminded him of what he dealt with losing his friend. And mm-hmm. I didn't ask who. I assume he meant Tupac or yeah. I don't know, but and that's what made me happy to be able to share the story, because there, you know, everybody has dealt with something like that as well, or will at yeah. some point in their life. So, but
well, I think a lot of people sort of give up, whether intentionally or not, right? But I can see how it would be tempting to just let that derail
yeah.
your path.
Well, in a way it did, because I was in a group with him, and I told myself after that, I'm not going to be in a group with anybody else. And I mm-hmm. haven't to this day, you know. Madlib is probably the closest thing to, like, a substitute to Charisma, where, like, I was focused on Madlib a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I met Charisma in 1990, and I wrote that essay on what I want to do when I grow up in 1985. And so the 85 idea was to do a label, and then the 1990s idea was to be in a group with Charisma. And when he died, and I went back to plan A,
mm-hmm.
Charisma was the plan B. But, you know, when I was with Charisma, his stuff was so good to me that it made me just want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And is that kind of what happens with other artists along the way? Like, do you find that, I mean, it sounds a little like, then that happened with Madlib, and then that happened with another artist, is that you draw sort of inspiration from them?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really close with Dame Funk, I guess, out of everyone on the label. Like, we're pretty close, like
mm-hmm.
we talk every day and stuff, and
mm-hmm.
are into a lot of the same music. But I mean, yeah, it's over the years I've just become, those have been become my friends, are the guys that
yeah
I work with musically.
And what about now? You know you mentioned people that you looked up to early on, and, you know, those affirmations or not, like, you know, from Bobito or whatever.
And Bobito said a lot of good stuff.
I'm sure. Yeah,
like,
of course.
I shouldn't have even said that. But
No. But
that was like, yeah, I mean.
But Bobito, he was on the yeah, show. You know, he's known for being really outspoken. And
right. And that's what's great, like, about him. Is that he keeps it 100. Yeah, always.
Definitely. So, so are there still people, who's out there now that you look up to in that way, or that whose opinion kind of matters?
I think just a lot of people I work with, like, a lot of, like, knowledge and
mm-hmm.
like this guy Alex, who records under the name Mild High Club. Like, when I find records, because I'm still discovering records every day, I'm like,
yeah.
I'll send emails like to like a select group of maybe 5 to 10 people, Mayor Hawthorne, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I just like getting their feedback, or I like showing them stuff still, you know, and that was like, that's why I started doing this. I mean, in high school I was making mixtapes for people, and every time I made a tape, I didn't have a dubbing deck, so you'd have to like do it from scratch each time, and
mm-hmm.
And each person's tape that they got was a little different than the other person, but it was kind of that sharing of music that I, you know, that I was doing. Well, shit, now it'll be 30 years, I guess. But yeah, that hasn't changed either.
Yeah. Do you still have, you know, you mentioned that essay you wrote in 1985. Do you still do that? Not essays, but do you still write your plans?
I don't write them on paper as much. It's mostly on the computer. But I've been told that it's really important to write things on paper physically. Like,
yeah,
it actually gets done more when you do that than just thinking it. I mean, I still have like a lot of, yeah, I have different ideas that I have written down, and I have money making ideas that I write down too that are not related to Stone's Throw, because I would, if Stone's Throw didn't make any more money for me, and I got my primary source of income somewhere else, it would be more liberating where I could really put out only what I want. I mean, there's nothing that I put out where I'm like, oh, that sucks. But there's albums that I'll put out where like not every song on it's great to me personally. But yeah.
What's something, I mean, you don't have to give any secrets, but you know, what's something you would do if you made all the money you needed somewhere else, and then what would you do with Stone's Throw?
Oh, what would I do with Stone's Throw? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I would even do it that much different than I do now, but
okay.
I know that iTunes, for example, sales are going way down on it. And
yeah.
You know, just assuming that, just in the off chance that things continue to sell less than they were, you know, God forbid. I mean, I would still want to keep putting records out.
Absolutely. And then what about working with brands? I know, you know, we had a couple opportunities to work together. Mm-hmm. When I was handling Mazda, we put Mayer on tour and did something together around that. And I know, you know, we did some stuff with Scion together. Mm-hmm. What is, you know, how does that work for you? Because obviously you have such a specific vision for the label and the music you're making. How do brands sort of naturally fit into that?
I think during the anniversaries, the brands are more interested. Like the 20 year next year, we have a lot of co-branding stuff in the works. But
nice.
For a lot of the times, I guess we don't do that many Stone's Throw shows, partially because the direction of the label's gone different ways, where you almost can't put like some of the artists on a bill together.
Right.
You know, just wouldn't make sense. So,
yeah.
And that's partially why I started another label. I have another label that I've done for more of the rock type stuff, I guess, for lack of a better term.
What's the name?
It's called Circle Star.
And okay.
So Mild High Club's the first artist that is basically like, you know, doing tours and stuff. I guess the first minor success on that label, but he kind of works with like Ariel Pink and Mac DeMarco, you know, a lot of the lo-fi. I mean, his stuff's like kind of 60s psychedelic, I guess.
Mm-hmm. But you guys, when did you make the Our Vinyl Weighs a Ton?
I think it's been like 3 years now, maybe.
And so that's a little unusual for you to make kind of your own movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we basically, these guys from France came to us and wanted to do a documentary, and they flew out, and you know, they filmed me and like as many people as they could for a month.
Mm-hmm.
And they put this movie together, and they had funding from, I think, the French government. It was going to be on national TV in France.
Nice.
And then for whatever reason, the French TV said no after they had all the footage and everything.
You're kidding.
Yeah, so they pulled the plug on it. And then while that was happening, these guys in LA hit us up and said, we want to do a documentary on Stone's Throw. And so I put them in touch with the guys in France, and they worked it all out. You know, they used that. They used the French footage as well as their own footage, as well as archival. And, you know, so it wasn't like an idea that I wanted. I never thought of doing a Stone's Throw movie. Like, it wasn't, you know, it was these guys basically came to us. And people through the years have always said, we want to do a documentary on Stone's Throw, and it never really turned into anything. So when these guys came to me originally, I was like, yeah, cool, whatever, we'll see what happens. But I wasn't holding my breath over it.
Yeah.
But they really were hard workers, and they made it happen. I mean,
and is that something you would do more of? Like, is there Stone's Throw Pictures? Is that coming?
No, I mean, I've always wanted to do a Dilla movie as well as a Madlib movie, but I mean, you know, a lot of people want to do that, so.
Sure.
Yeah. But even the Stone's Throw doc, I mean, I never thought it would be like playing at the Arc Light and, you know, being on Netflix and all that stuff. Like, the guys did a pretty good job of getting it out there, you know.
Absolutely. But what about artists? Like, is there something that they learn from you?
Gotta ask them.
Okay. Is there something you want them to learn from you?
No, I'm not here to teach them anything, really.
Okay.
I was thinking that knowledge, he went to Asia for the first time, and he was really blown away, and it was, like, eye-opening for him, and he, like, sent me an email, like, just thanking me and, like, you know, just really appreciative, and I'm not used to hearing that, like, that direct, you know. Like, I mean, everyone I work with is really easy to work with. But that was pretty cool. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Who's your favorite DJ?
Oh, J-Rock comes to mind right off the bat. Dame Funk, James Pants. J-Rock's really technical. I mean, I love what Madlib does DJing too. Madlib doesn't... He doesn't let anything influence him other than just playing what he wants to play, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Like with Stone's Throw, I feel like I'm a lot more to the left than I am with DJing. Like, when you're DJing, you have a dance floor, and a lot of... if not most of the, well, probably at least half of the people who are there don't even know who you are. They got invited by someone else or whatever.
Sure.
So you want to kind of make sure everyone's having a good time. It's kind of, but, I mean, Dame's always very underground with his selections, and he's so good on the mic that he can kind of get away with playing more, lesser known music and stuff. Mm-hmm. I think so. He's an inspiration to me, definitely, DJing.
Can you think of a favorite live show that you've ever seen?
I mean, just because we were talking about Dame, I was just thinking of a show that he did in San Francisco that I was really, like, happy to be at, and my girlfriend had never seen him live, and she was really into it, and she, you know, she didn't know what to expect. I guess she doesn't even necessarily listen to that much Stone's Throw stuff. Like, she's kind of more in a different scene, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So YMO was good live. Saw them recently.
Oh yeah,
Yellow Magic Orchestra. That was cool.
Any new acts you're checking for, folks that aren't maybe not on the label?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm in talks with some guys that I want to sign, so I don't want to mention that till after.
No, I meant stuff that's out.
Like, yeah, oh, right. Oh,
just new,
like,
records.
Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, Flying Lotus has been putting out some good stuff on his label that... Thundercat, like, his stuff's been really good. And the jazzy stuff that they've been putting out.
Nobody move, there's blood on the floor. And I can't find my heart. Where did it go? Did I leave it in the dark?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still like learning about music every day, though, new and old.
Sure. Nice. Well, thanks for being here, man. I appreciate it.
Yeah, man.
This is fun. Come Absolutely. Back anytime. You want to promote something? Send your artist by.
Okay. I thought you meant like right now.
No, no.
No.
But
yeah.
Give us the where to find you on social.
On what?
On social.
Oh, on socials?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know if you was Stone's Throw.
Oh.
Well, it's the Instagram's the hardest. It's PNTBTRWLF. I probably need to. I shouldn't have made that.
That's cool. One, make, the other ones make are people PB find
Wolf.
It.
Yeah.
PB Wolf, otherwise.
I mean, PB Wolf at Twitter and Facebook.
Cool.
Yep.
Thanks, man.
Pretty simple. Thanks. But
that just masked the problem, so we smashed Peanut Butter Wolf, y'all. I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. Come back next week for more Rebel Radio. In the meantime, leave us a note on Twitter. Subscribe on iTunes. Follow us on SoundCloud. Do something with your life. Peace.